Seattle's Morning News, Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. The CDC says healthcare workers, even if they are infected with COVID, can go back to their jobs as long as they don't have symptoms and as long as they're wearing masks. They have to do this because they just don't have enough people to take care of the patients. Let's check in with somebody who goes into hospitals every day.
Patient Dr. Cohen.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. So the current CDC standards, Dr. Cohen, for healthcare workers are what?
The CDC has now revised their guidelines such that it allows for healthcare workers who are COVID positive but have mild symptoms to actually return to work. Now, I was sort of curious to see what would happen. And in fact, this past week, Dignity Health, who is the fifth largest healthcare provider in the country, with private locations primarily in California, Nevada, and Arizona, they announced that they are, in fact, doing exactly that. They're allowing healthcare workers who are COVID positive but with mild or no symptoms to return to work. And I find that somewhat curious. I find the recommendation, in fact, curious. I understand the practical aspect, which is that, well, there's a shortage of healthcare workers to begin with, and when they're out sick, it further exacerbates that shortage. But I do find it curious because, by definition, anybody who's in a hospital for any reason, let's say you have a car wreck, you're by definition immunosuppressed.
Yeah.
So if you have your healthcare workers running around who are also COVID positive, you could essentially come into the hospital with a car wreck but leave with COVID. And I think that's a little bit challenging. Now, this is in the face of us quite well aware now that the Omicron variant is highly transmissible, whether or not you're vaccinated and boosted or not. And in fact, this past week, Dr. Fauci said that the Omicron variant is essentially going to touch everybody in society. He tried to qualify it by then saying that those who have been vaccinated and boosted will fare better, although I don't know that we actually have evidence that that's the case. It just may be that the Omicron variant is just less lethal and more transmissible.
So at the hospitals where you work, have you reached capacity where you have so many COVID patients, you have to postpone the elective surgeries?
The answer is yes. And I think that's happening nationwide, that hospitals have had to curtail a lot of elective surgery and regulate what goes on within the hospital, keep beds open. And so I understand these new guidelines in terms of their practical application, that we need nurses and doctors and other healthcare providers to be present in the hospital to care for patients. But at the same time, if they're coming in with COVID, we may be actually exposing vulnerable people to the illness. And it basically puts us 100% dependent on wearing masks. And, you know, there's been a lot of recent information about masks showing that cloth masks really don't do a whole heck of a lot.
Right.
And really, it's primarily the N95 or KN95 masks that are effective. And if you've noticed lately, you see our politicians now are all wearing N95 or KN95 masks based on that. But in fact, hospitals have not made that mandatory. And so in hospitals, people are still wearing, you know, the typical paper masks or surgical masks.
Well, now explain that to me, because as far as I know, there's no shortage. I mean, I told people 6 months ago, stock up on these masks because at some point, you know, they're going to be in demand again. But I would think that the hospitals learned from the first time around to have a stockpile, didn't they? Didn't they buy enough N95s for this latest surge?
They did, but they're still not necessarily mandating that you need to wear it. And I think this has all gotten very confusing. And for example, people with facial hair, I mean, I have a beard and a mustache. You know, an N95 or KN95 mask does not fit me well. So they're not as efficacious in people who have facial hair. You know, it is confusing. And hospitals are, on one hand, saying, you know, return to work even if you're COVID positive. Then they're recommending a tight-fitting mask, but they're not mandating that it be an N95 or KN95 mask.
So if I have, you know, an elderly relative going to the hospital for hernia surgery, I'd want him to come back with a repaired abdomen. I don't want him coming back with some infection. I don't care if it's just the common cold that he caught in the hospital. And I would, and for that reason, I would expect that whoever operates on him would be wearing the best mask available.
Right. Well, I think all hospitals do require healthcare workers to wear masks inside the hospital. The question is, you're asking is, should they be wearing a specific type of mask at work? And I don't have a good answer for you, because the hospital is just one place where you could be potentially exposed. I would actually argue that the CDC, by changing the guidelines and the recommendations and allowing healthcare workers who are COVID positive to return to work, is a greater risk than whatever type of mask that they choose to wear.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. Dr. Cohen, thank you.
Thanks, Dave.
One thing we know for sure is that there's a vast difference between the N95s and the other masks. I don't know if you saw it over the weekend, but the Seattle Times published a helpful little table based on CDC research. This research was done last spring before Omicron emerged. And, of course, we know Omicron spreads more easily. But it's a helpful little table. So, for example, if you're uninfected and you come in the presence of a person who is infected and the two of you are wearing nothing, you're likely to get infected after just 15 minutes in that person's presence, okay? Wearing a cloth mask protects you for maybe 20 minutes. It's just not a big advantage.
Nothing.
Wearing one of those disposable masks that everybody hands out, you know, those little surgical things, that protects you for 30 minutes.
Oh, I thought they were better.
Wearing the N95 protects you for 2.5 hours.
Oh.
And then if you go down, and then if you are both wearing N95s, right, which is the best case scenario, you're protected for 25 hours.
Oh, my goodness.
Whereas
that's
if you're
too much time with one person, but.
Exactly. Yes, you're unlikely to hang around with that person for 25 hours. But look it up, because it'll give you that perspective. Then you can decide. I mean, the N95s I found are perfectly comfortable once you get used to them.
But these are non-vaccinated people.
What's that?
Those scenarios, both people are not vaccinated.
Right. Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, the likelihood of that being the case, I mean, I don't think we're speaking to many non-vaccinated people right now. Right. So N95 masks on both, plus fully vaxxed and boosted.
Yeah.
But
we know that unvaccinated people can still get the virus. They just don't die of it or go to the hospital most of the time.
Right. 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 Yeah.
Seattle's Morning News. While court proceedings have been limited once again because of COVID, there were still several dozen sentencings in King County last week. Let's go to Cairo News Radio's Hannah Scott, who joins us live. Good morning, Hannah.
Good morning, Dave. Our first case, we'll center on just a handful of them. There was about half of what we usually see because of the slowdown in the court proceedings. First up, Casey McNerney with the King County Prosecutor's Office says
Richard Peter Messias. He pleaded guilty to robbery in the first degree, and this incident started out at Harborview, where he carjacked a man, and while he was doing so, stabbed him in the face. He was ultimately convicted of robbery in the first degree, and a lot of people say, why not carjacking? There's not an actual criminal charge called carjacking. It depends on what happens in the carjacking. So in this case, it's a robbery first degree because there was an injury of him knifing the guy in his cheek. Carjackings can go anywhere from that to theft if there's not an injury there, if there's not a person in the vehicle, or it can be a murder case if the person who's carjacked is killed.
Unfortunately, that was not the case here. Casey says this guy, in the end, ended up getting a sentence of more than 5 years and then some community custody. The second case involves a drive-by shooting, but not the kind that you'd normally think of.
This is a guy who's got a history of attempted robbery out of Florida, and also in September of 2020 was the subject of an extreme risk protection order out of Snohomish County. In this case, not long after that, he fired a gun out a window of a car multiple times on a public street. And the victim in this case reported hearing the defendant yell at him before the shots were fired. And he could, what the victim said was that he could hear the bullet whiz by his head.
And so the one before that, that was just a few days before that, where the extreme risk protection order was taken out, he'd gone up to a random person, held a gun to that person's head and threatened to kill him for several minutes. And he violated the extreme risk protection order as well as some other things. What's interesting, Casey says, is what this guy said in his guilty plea.
What he said was is that he was having a mental health crisis. But he also said, and this is a quote, he said, but I acknowledge my conduct was still reckless. And this goes to what you were talking about before, of when you have somebody who has a mental health history and they go to prison, that's a big part of the sentence, and there's accountability too. But people also think that there's fantastic mental health treatment in prison. There's very often not. That's why we also push for things like mental health court when it's appropriate, or drug court or veterans court when it's appropriate, and would like to see additional mental health treatment in prisons.
So something that they continue to push lawmakers on. I want to get to our last case. This is a case that involves justice nearly 20 years in the making.
This case happened all the way back in 2006 is when it started at the Torchlight Parade in downtown Seattle. The victim was a 12-year-old girl. The defendant was 30 years old at the time. The 12-year-old had run away from home and had come to Seattle and tried to locate her mother. This was in the summer of 2006. She was in the 600 block of Yesler Street and was asking for people for help to locate her mom. And she asked this guy if she could use his cell phone. And he said, sure. And then he pulled her into an alley and put his hand around her neck. And she started to cry. And that's when he raped her.
That was in 2006. And this case just went to trial a few years ago. Why so long?
She reported the incident that night, went to the hospital for a sexual assault kit. What's also frustrating about this case is that rape test kit sat untested for years. And it wasn't until September of 2018, 12 years after the rape happened, that the State Patrol Crime Lab notified the Seattle Police Department that the DNA that was collected the night of the rape from this 12-year-old's underwear came back to the defendant.
And on Friday, he was finally sentenced and got the maximum sentence, Casey says.
The range for this one, based off of his history, and he's got other convictions. One of them's child molestation. He also has a 1994 rape conviction, another rape conviction in 2001. He failed to register as a sex offender in 2007 after this case happened, before they realized that he was the one who raped his 12-year-old. Has a long history of sexual violence. The range for him, the standard range is 210 to 280 months. The maximum is life, and on Friday he was sentenced to life without the possibility of release.
Well, that makes us all feel a little more secure, I think. I'm still puzzled, though. I mean, this is an especially egregious crime. How would that evidence have just sat there for so long?
The same way that the other 10,000 rape kits that were not tested did. Just various reasons, not enough oversight or staffing or policy in place at various police departments. In some cases, it just wasn't a priority for various police departments. It's just the way it went. I mean, that's how you ended up with a rape kit that was from 1981 when they finally did the full inventory. This woman is 27 years old, and she was virtually. She was in court on the phone with her victim advocate on Friday for this sentencing after waiting, after being 12 years old. It took longer than she had been alive when she was attacked to get this case through the court system, and it's absolutely unacceptable.
Do we have any idea? I mean, did seeing this help her?
I've not had an opportunity to talk with her, so I don't know that. I don't know that. But I imagine the fact that she was there shows that she needed to have that that closure, right? And the other thing is, too, Florida has its own rape kit backlogs. They had to extradite this guy from Florida. So all of the previous crimes that came up with him in the CODIS system, when they finally did put his DNA through, it's all prior to this attack on this girl in 2006. But there is almost every state has a rape kit backlog. Florida had an 8,000 rape kit backlog and still is working its way through that. So he may not be in that system. There's no way to tell what he's done since then. If he's not in CODIS, it doesn't mean he didn't attack again.
Yeah. Well, he won't be able to attack now.
Life with no parole. Yep. So a good sentence.
Yeah. Car Radio's Hannah Scott. Hannah, thank you.
You bet.
Time for the Daily Dose of Kindness now, sponsored by Heritage Homecraft. It's a love story that spans decades of hurt and racial tensions and ultimately ends in the purest act of kindness, caretaking. CBS's Steve Hartman has the story.
For most of her adult life, 68-year-old Jean Gustafson has suffered from chronic regret.
Can't turn back the clock. I wish I could.
Would you do anything different?
Yes, I would have married him.
What Jean so regrets is breaking up with her college sweetheart.
So this was in the spring of 72.
A guy she met in the German club at Loyola University in Chicago.
This is Steve and I in the back here.
Jean says he would have made the perfect husband.
A lot of memories here.
If only he'd been white.
My mother was absolutely livid. I mean,
what did she say?
What didn't she say? How could I disgrace the family? It was not pretty.
Partly because of those pressures, Jean broke up with Steve Watts and never saw him again. Until a few months ago, when she tracked him down at this Chicago nursing home.
What I found was sort of a broken man.
Like Jean, Steve was divorced with no kids. But life for him had been much harder. He'd fallen on terrible times. He was homeless, had two strokes, and was almost unrecognizable the day Jean walked back into his life.
But he's still the wonderful, gorgeous man that I knew.
Did all those feelings come rushing back?
Yes, for both of us.
And so, with her mother no longer in the way, Jean made arrangements to move Steve from the nursing home to her home in Portland, Oregon.
Sleeping.
I feel terribly lucky that I get a second chance.
Steve?
Steve's health issues have left him bedridden, but his mind is sharp and his heart young. In fact, if you listen closely, you can still hear his devotion, unwavering after all these years.
I love you.
Race drove its wedge, and love wormed its way back. And their story isn't over, I don't think.
Has he proposed?
I'm not at liberty to say.
Hypothetically, if he did propose, what would your answer be?
Hypothetically, yes.
Sounds like a follow-up.
Should I book a ticket?
Hypothetically, yes.
She's giddy like a schoolgirl, isn't
she? Wow, what a story.
Yeah.
I told you my mom had a boyfriend.
Oh, yeah?
At the assisted living center. Towards the end of her life, too.
Oh, yeah? Fabulous. Oh, this
but,
is...
Nothing like... Steve's story there. Wow.
Yeah. Seeing her walk in with a tray of food for him and then to see him struggle to speak, but just tell her he loves. I mean, it's just love is the answer.
7:48 and now from the Gene Ursula Show, which you can hear starting at 9 o'clock on Cairo Radio. G. Scott, Martin Luther King Jr. Day. And we typically listen back to some of his speeches today. I understand you have some quotes that are lesser known.
Well, maybe one or two. Today is the role reversal day. And what I mean is the role reversal where the entire country pretends to, a lot of our country pretends to celebrate a man whose achievements and values that they spent the previous 364 days ignoring, demonizing, and trying to dismantle. There's folks that spend every single day of their life and doing everything the exact opposite of what Dr. King was fighting for. As a matter of fact, on the Gene Ursula Show today, we will talk about there's a bill right now that's sponsored by Representative Grad Clippert of Kennewick, House Bill 1886. It would ban any teaching in schools, including any classroom discussion about the notion that institutions in this country can be structurally racist.
Mm-hmm, I saw that.
Let that sink in for a second. So today is a day of performative praise where it will be just kind of exhausting to see the platforms across the country, politicians or people all day on social media. They're going to tell you their version of what Dr. King wanted. No, they won't tell you that he challenged systemic racism, spoke out on police brutality, and actually advocated for universal basic income. So today is like one of those days where it will be, the quotes will be cherry picked, right? It will be speeches, and some will say, let me listen to what G. Scott has to say today, because I'm sure he's going to have some inspirational quote. Sure, I can give you all of those different quotes. But before I do, I want to be clear about one thing. Dr. Martin Luther King lived on this earth for 39 years. He's only 39 years old.
Yeah.
No, he didn't give his life. He was murdered. The other day I heard that President Biden's approval rating is at 32%. I'm like, man, that was news, right? Like, oh, man, his approval rating is only 32%. And I thought, that's ironic. Because then if you go back to 1966, there was a Gallup poll that measured the approval rating of Dr. King. Guess what it was? It was 32%. Yeah. 32% approved of Dr. King in 1966, while 63% had a negative approval rating of him. That same year, a December, a Harris poll found that 50% of white people felt Dr. King was hurting the cause of civil rights, while only 36% thought that he was helping. And when he was assassinated in 1968, 3 out of 4 white Americans disapproved of him. So you ask for a quote. I'll give you guys a quote, and I'll just kind of end it with this. Dr. King was an amazing man. I believe that his legacy today is living on. I believe that so many people are trying to, if you will, live their life as they stand on the shoulders of the giants that come before us, the legacy. They are out here fighting every single day against the same things that he fought against all this time. Sometimes you'll hear people say, well, where's the Dr. Martin Luther King now in the black community? We need him. Really? Because they're all over. They're all over. They're all doing work. As a matter of fact, I don't even have time to go into what's going on with voting today. So here's a quote. He who passively accepts evil is as much involved in it as he who helps to perpetuate it. He who accepts evil without protesting against it is really cooperating with it. That's what Dr. King said. Mm-hmm.
So he was also embarking on the poor people's campaign at the time he was assassinated. He was in Memphis for that garbage strike.
Which is ironic what's going on in Bellevue right now.
Yeah.
Right? Like the worker sanitation strike. That's why he was in Memphis to be about that.
I mean, it wasn't just about voting rights. It was about economic equity. And, of course, also, the other thing going on back in those days, of course, was the Vietnam War, which he took a stand against, which I think probably also had to do with the polling data that you talked about. I mean, I certainly remember growing up in those years. He was not looked at by a lot of people the same way he's looked at now. And he knew himself. I mean, remember the speech? I've seen the mountaintop. I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you. Right.
Right. But I'll say this over the weekend. And as I come into today, I'm truly encouraged, and I'm encouraged by the progress that continues to happen. And I'm encouraged with the understanding of the role that some of us that are living today have to do as much as we can so that the next generation can do their part. And you have some that say, well, things are so much better. You know what? They are. And they're that much better because there has been a constant fight for better. Right. And I'm not naive to know that things aren't better than they were in the 50s and 60s. And I'm also not naive that I do believe that our country can be better than what it is. And so I think that's what his legacy is about, is for us that are here today to do as much as we can so that the next generation can take over and take it from there.
G. Scott with Ursula, 9 o'clock on Chi Radio. Thanks, G. Last November, newcomer Sarah Perry unseated one of the longest-serving members of the King County Council. She now represents District 3, and she talked with Cairo News Radio's Hannah Scott.
Taking over the seat held by Kathy Lambert for nearly 20 years is Sarah Perry's first go-around in elected office, but she's worked in public service for years. Still, she admits this is a different animal. Her prior public service included work as the Chief Development Officer for Social Venture Partners International. She was Executive Director at Eastside Housing and also Senior Director of University Initiatives at Seattle University, among other careers. At this point, she's excited.
So excited to get going, and I cannot wait to work with this great group of folks. Everybody's been so welcoming at King County as a whole. And the council members just really going out of their way to be supportive. It's been really great, really great. And that isn't to say it's not like drinking from a fire hose right now, because it is.
She says priority one is listening.
So my job is to go to the different communities, to go to the chambers, to go to the environmental communities, go to the business communities, go to education, to go to the Muslim Association of Puget Sound and the Indian Association of Western Washington and the Latino community, the Hmong community, to go to all of these different communities and really listen to what's working and what's not working, how King County can be supportive, where they can bring their expertise and their talents into the conversation together with the others, to really look at what is working together and what we're going to do for the next 10 years together as the second fastest growing district.
One of our other big priorities.
Behavioral health is very important to me. We're at crisis point in this country, certainly in this state. And, you know, we are behind Mississippi. We're behind Tennessee in our behavioral health support services. And we don't have to be. This is an amazing state. We have incredible possibilities. And I do think we're at a tipping point with this. I'm thrilled with what UW is doing with their behavioral health center. They're just starting on that. It's so exciting. The work that Mark Dones is doing with the Kim County Homelessness Authority, and a lot of work to do.
She wants to focus on increased access to behavioral health services, ensuring adequate funding for the existing programs and support new programs to strengthen the behavioral health workforce.
King County has designated crisis responders from the crisis line. You're familiar with that. And, you know, and they go forward and they have particular training, and it's really important that they're brought in. When you call them, they'll get back to you. If it's a crisis, they'll try to get back to you within the day. So you're in a family crisis or a crisis with a friend or a community member who is having a psychotic break, which is just simple chemistry. Like, we all have different kinds of chemistry going on in our brains. And for some of us, we're hearing voices, which is a definer of schizophrenia. It's not something to be afraid of. It's something to live with and engage with and work together on and have medication so that folks can actually live stable lives.
Addressing poverty is also a big concern for Perry.
You're deciding between putting your kids in childcare or paying the rent, so you're living in the car. Right. That's a help we can offer through a rental assistance and identifying basic poverty spaces.
And then there's the substance abuse issue.
If it's drug and alcohol addiction, some of these folks, you know, people aren't going to get the help until they're ready and they want it. Some of them will want it. Some of them won't. Some of them that don't want the help, very small portion can be violent. And those are the ones that end up getting all the media attention and really bring in the fear for folks. And that's a very particular issue we have to work on in that aspect, right? What do we do in that case?
Perry admits she doesn't have all the answers. Other key areas she hopes to focus on is the environment, prioritizing and protecting farms, forests, air, and water with support for the Growth Management Act and zoning laws. Equity is also top on her list. Access and opportunity, promoting workforce and affordable housing, and small business support, especially as we emerge from the pandemic. For now, though, the plan is to engage community, listen, and learn.
Interested in working with people who are reflective, not reactive, not, you know, not trying to fight about things, but actually want the forward movement together, and bring those folks together in a King County community coalition as representatives of these different communities, and looking at what the possibilities are with King County with those different areas, and how we can work with the not 9 but 10 different cities in this district when you include the small portion of Bothell as well as Woodinville, and work with the mayors who are the experts in their cities and the surrounding areas, and work with the state as well,
and give us all another update down the line. Hannah Scott, Cairo News Radio.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News, the podcast. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. You can find our podcast weekday mornings right at 9:30.
And if you subscribe, you will never miss the Daily Dose of Kindness.